Flash Notes Podcast, episode number 9, audiobook summary on The Power of Habit. Welcome to the Flash Notes Podcast, the podcast for busy professionals that need knowledge now. Brought to you by Flash Notes Book Summaries at getflashnotes.com, where you can get best-selling business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. My name is Dean Bukhari, your host here at the Flash Notes Podcast, where every week we work to bring you the big ideas and actionable insights from some of the best business and self-improvement books out there to help you succeed in life and in business. So tune in, buckle up, and enjoy the ride as we dive into today's episode right here on the Flash Notes Podcast. Hello, it's Dean Bukhari with another Flash Notes Audible book summary at getflashnotes.com. And today's audiobook summary is going to be on The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, written by Charles Duhigg. In the summary, you're going to learn why the brain tries to make routines into habits, how cravings create and fuel new habits, how to apply the golden rule of habit change, and what keystone habits are and the importance of them in creating a new routine or ritual or habit for yourself. Let's jump into the overview here before we go into the big ideas. So in The Power of Habit, Charles Duhigg, award-winning business reporter for the New York Times, takes us into this really thrilling edge of science here and the discoveries behind them that explain why habits actually exist. And then he goes into how they can actually be changed. And that's the big, big, big important thing to keep in mind here as we go into these flash notes and the big ideas within them. Because it's one thing to know where the habit is coming from. It's one thing to know why you have developed a habit. And it's a completely different ballgame when we're talking about how to actually create new habits and change old habits and bad habits and replace them with better ones that are going to actually serve us and help us move forward with our goals in life and in business and in any other arena that we are trying to improve upon or get better at. So he explains and kind of takes us on to the thrilling edge of scientific discoveries, and he explains why habits exist, how they can be changed, and he distills a vast amount of information into engrossing narratives and stories, and he brings to light a whole new understanding of human nature and its potential for transformation. And along the way, we learn why some people and companies struggle to change despite years and years of trying, while others seem to be making changes overnight, seemingly. And we revisit laboratories where neuroscientists explore how habits work and where they actually reside in our brains. And we discover how the right habits were crucial to the successful promotion of Pepsodent, for example, to Tony Dungy, who led his team to a Super Bowl win by changing one step in his player's habit loop, and to Alcoa, when it turned itself around by changing just one routine within the organization. At its core, The Power of Habit contains an exhilarating argument. And that argument is the key to exercising regularly, losing weight, raising exceptional children, becoming more productive, building revolutionary companies and social movements, and achieving success is understanding how habits work. By harnessing this new science, we can transform our businesses and our communities and our lives and move them forward for the better. So when you woke up this morning, what'd you do first? Did you hop into the shower? Did you check your email, your Gmail? Did you grab a donut from the kitchen counter? Did you brush your teeth before or after you toweled off? Which route did you take to work? When you got home, did you put on your sneakers and go for a run? Or did you pour yourself a drink and eat dinner in front of the TV? All our life, so far as it has definite form, is but a mass of habits, says William James, and he wrote that back in 1892. Most of the choices that we make each and every single day might feel like the products of well-considered decision-making, but the truth is, they're not. They're habits. And although each habit means relatively little on its own, over time, the meals that we order, whether we save or spend, how often we exercise, and the way we organize our thoughts and work routines have an enormous impact on our health, our productivity, our financial security, and our overall sense of well-being and happiness. For example, one of the papers produced and published by Duke University researcher in 2006 found that more than 40% of the actions people performed each day weren't actual decisions, but they were actually habits. James, like countless others from Aristotle to Oprah, spent much of his life trying to understand why habits exist. But only in the past two decades have scientists and marketers really begun understanding how habits work, and more important, how they actually change. At one point, we all consciously decided how much to eat and what to focus on and when we are going to get to the office and how often have a drink or when to go for a jog and so on and so forth. And then we stopped making a choice and the behavior became automatic. It's a natural consequence of our neurology. And by understanding how it happens, you can rebuild those patterns in whichever way you choose. Let's jump into the key insights and big ideas here, with the first one being that habits are simple cue routine reward loops that save effort and endure. So our brains are constantly looking for ways to save energy. Research shows that one way they do this is by turning activities into habits. Hence, even a complicated act that demands concentration at first, like backing out of the driveway, for instance, eventually becomes an effortless habit. Research has indicated that as many as 40% of the actions you perform each and every single day are based on habit and not on conscious decision making. In general, any habit can actually be broken down into a three-part loop. First, you sense an external cue, say your alarm clock ringing, for instance, and then this creates an overall spike in your brain activity as your brain decides which habit is appropriate for that particular situation. Next comes the routine, meaning the activity you're used to performing when faced with this particular cue, or whatever it is that you've been conditioned to do, whatever action you've been conditioned to take or conditioned yourself to take when you get this little trigger in your mind, or when you get this external trigger or a particular cue of some sort. So you march into the bathroom and brush your teeth with your brain virtually on autopilot, for instance, when your alarm goes off in the morning, right? Finally, you get a reward of some kind, a feeling of success, and in this case, a minty, fresh, tingling sensation in your mouth. Your overall brain activity increases again, and as your brain registers the successful completion of the activity and reinforces the link between the cue and the routine, you have now just then completed the three-part loop of your morning routine habit of alarm clock going off, climbing out of bed, brushing your teeth, and feeling that little bit of a reward feeling that you just actually did a little micro action there. You just performed a habit. And all of this you've done so often and so deliberately every single day that it eventually became non-deliberate. It eventually became part of what you just do. It became automatic. But think back when you were a young kid and mom or dad or whatever caretaker you had in your life was teaching you how to brush your teeth. It wasn't automatic back then, but after years and years and years of conditioning, it became a habit. So habits are incredibly, incredibly resilient things. In some cases, people with extensive brain damage who could not even remember where they lived could still adhere to their old habits and pick up new ones. This is because learning and maintaining habits is something that happens actually within the part of your brain called the basal ganglia. Now, this is a part of your brain that can function normally even if the rest of your brain is damaged. Unfortunately, this resilience means that even if you kick a bad habit, like smoking for instance, you will always be at risk of relapsing. Habits stick because they create craving. Imagine this scenario. Every afternoon for the past year, you've bought and eaten a delicious, sugar-laden chocolate chip cookie from the cafeteria at your workplace. Call it a just reward for a hard day's work. Unfortunately, as a few friends have already pointed out, you've started to put a little weight around the belly there. So you decide to kick the habit. But how do you imagine you'll feel that first afternoon walking past the cafeteria, whereas you usually would have just went out and grabbed that cookie? Odds are you'll either eat just one more cookie or you'll go home in a distinctly grumpy mood. Kicking a bad habit is hard because you develop a craving for the reward at the end of the habit loop. And studies on animals have shown that once they become used to a simple cue, routine, reward habit, their brains begin anticipating the reward even before they actually get it. And once they anticipate it, denying them the actual reward makes them frustrated and mopey and irritated. And this is the neurological basis of craving. Craving works for good habits as well. Research indicates that people who manage to exercise habitually crave something from the exercise, be it the endorphin rush in their brain, the sense of accomplishment, or the treat they allow themselves afterwards. This craving is actually what solidifies the habit. Cues and rewards alone are not enough. Companies and advertisers work really, really hard to understand and create such cravings in consumers. Consider Claude Hopkins, the man who popularized Pepsodent toothpaste, when countless other toothpastes had failed and continued to fail and couldn't find a solution. Claude Hopkins provided a reward that created craving, namely the cool tingling sensation that today is a staple of all toothpastes. That sensation not only quote-unquote proved that the product worked in consumers' minds, it also became a tangible reward that they actually began to crave. To change a habit, substitute the routine for another and believe in the change. Ask any smoker looking to quit. When the craving for nicotine hits, it is hard to ignore. Hence, the trick is to still respond to the craving, but with something other than smoking. Side hint, this is why the old myth of replacing the cigarette with a lollipop came about and became so popular. So this is the golden rule of changing any habit. Do not resist craving. Instead, what you want to do is actually redirect the craving. So do not resist craving, redirect it. Keep the same cues and rewards, but change the routine that occurs as a result of that craving. So for instance, again, with the smoking example, if you had the craving for nicotine and you wanted to go out and smoke a cigarette, but you've been wanting to quit, then simply keep a handful of lollipops or sugar-free lollipops or whatever else, and keep those nearby or in your pocket or somewhere you can easily grab, just as if you were to easily grab your cigarettes. Heck, you might even pull out all of the tobacco and the cigarettes from the pack and replace it with the little sugar candy cigarettes or lollipops or something else. And every time you have a craving, you can even step outside, even though you don't need to, and just suck on your lollipop or nibble on a little pretzel or something. And that will help you to redirect the craving rather than resisting the craving. So essentially what you're doing is replacing it with something else that's better for you. So research indicates that one of the best known habit-changing organizations in the world uses this very method to massively improve their effectiveness across various realms. And that organization is AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it may have helped as many as 10 million alcoholics achieve sobriety. So AA asks participants to list what exactly it is that they crave from drinking. Usually, factors like relaxation and companionship are far more important than the actual intoxication itself. So then what AA does is it provides new routines that address those specific cravings. In this case, relaxation and companionship and social connection. So, for example, going to meetings and talking to sponsors for companionship effectively substitute drinking for something that's more harmful. And you replace those with something that's less harmful again. So this generally works, but stressful circumstances can cause relapses again. For example, one recovering alcoholic had been sober for years when his mother called to say she had cancer. After hanging up, he left work and went directly to a bar and then, in his own words, was, quote, pretty much drunk for the next 2 years. Research indicates that the differentiating component between relapses and continued sobriety is belief. Again, the differentiating factor between relapses and continued sobriety is the power of belief. Now, spirituality and God feature prominently in Alcoholics Anonymous philosophy, but it's not necessarily the religious component itself that helps people stay sober. Believing in God merely helps participants to also believe in the possibility of change for themselves, which then makes them stronger in the face of stressful life events. Change can be achieved by focusing on keystone habits and achieving small wins. When former government bureaucrat Paul O'Neill became the CEO of the ailing aluminum company, Alcoa, investors were very, very skeptical. Their apprehension was not necessarily helped by the fact that rather than talking about profits and revenues, O'Neill declared his number one priority was workplace safety. One investor immediately called his clients to say, "The board put a crazy hippie in charge and he's going to kill the company." This was terrible advice as O'Neill turned Alcoa around, increasing its annual income by a factor of 5. He understood that habits also exist in organizations and that if he wanted to change Alcoa's fate, he needed to change its habits. But not all habits are created equal. Some so-called keystone habits are more important than others because adhering to them creates positive effects that spill over into other areas. For instance, research indicates that doctors have a hard time getting obese people to make a broad change in their lifestyle. But when patients focus on developing one keystone habit, such as keeping a meticulous food journal, other positive habits start to take root as well. So making one specific change and focusing on that, it tends to bring about a positive change and positive habits in various other arenas of life as well. This is also why, as a side note, why somebody can go to the gym and begin seeing an external physical improvement in their body, and then that all of a sudden begins to increase and boost their level of confidence, which then boosts their level of charisma, which then helps them become more determined to go after those goals that they previously didn't think that they could go after. So you see how it kind of just helps you just increase yourself and better yourself in almost every other dimension in your life if you can focus on one specific thing oftentimes, and oftentimes in certain situations. So for O'Neill, by insisting that worker safety come first at Alcoa, he focused and forced managers and employees to think about how the manufacturing process could be safer and how those suggestions could be best communicated to everybody. And the end result was a highly, highly streamlined and hence profitable production and organization at Alcoa. And the reason a Keystone Habit, by the way, works is, again, that it provides small wins, meaning early successes that are fairly easy to attain and achieve are what the foundation of a Keystone Habit is built upon. And it's, again, it's built on micro wins, little wins, small successes. And achieving the Keystone Habit helps you believe that the change in other spheres of life, again, is possible as well, starting a cascade or a domino effect, if you will, of positive changes and results. Willpower is the most important Keystone Habit. A famous Stanford University study showed that four-year-olds with more willpower, as demonstrated by their ability to resist the temptation of a tasty marshmallow, went on to do far better in life academically and socially than their less determined peers. Willpower, it seemed, was a keystone habit that could be parlayed into other areas of life too. Further research revealed that willpower is in fact a skill that can indeed be learned. But why then is our willpower so seemingly inconsistent? Some days hitting the gym is no problem, whereas on other days leaving the sofa is nearly impossible. It turns out that willpower is actually like a muscle. It can get tired. It can deplete. If you exhaust it, concentrating on, say, a tedious spreadsheet at work, you might have no willpower left when you get home. But the analogy goes even further. By engaging in habits that demand resolution, say adhering to a strict diet, you can actually strengthen your willpower. A willpower workout, if you will. But other factors can also affect your willpower. For example, Starbucks found that on most days, all of its employees had the willpower to smile and be cheerful, regardless of how they felt. But when things became stressful, for example, when a customer began screaming, they would lose their cool. Based on research, executives at Starbucks determined that if baristas mentally prepared for unpleasant situations and made a plan of how to overcome them, then they could muster enough willpower to follow the plan even when they were under pressure. This is like role-playing in a sales scenario as well, by the way. And other studies have shown that a lack of autonomy or control also adversely affects willpower. If people do something because they are ordered to do it rather than by choice, their willpower muscles will get tired much quicker. As a side note, now think about that and apply it to one of the astonishing numbers that continues to increase on the Gallup polls every single year when they do this study, and that study I'm referring to is the state of the American workplace. And generally, when Gallup conducts this poll, at least in the United States, from what I know, the numbers continue to rise in terms of employee dissatisfaction. The typical employee's level of satisfaction and their lack of engagement and what they term as disengagement or active disengagement in the United States as of right now is 70%+ of either disengaged or actively disengaged employees. That means they're either unfulfilled, kind of saying, "Eh, I could do better," or just kind of blah, or they just hate their jobs completely. And a large part of that has to do with the lack of autonomy, choice, and control that the typical employee has in the typical working environment. So, two excellent solutions that have been proposed to this issue were by The first one being Drive, written by Daniel Pink. You can check out the flash notes for that. And then also the second one being Leaders Eat Last, Why Some Teams Pull Together and Others Don't, written by Simon Sinek, if you want to check that one out. So just thought I'd throw that out there for you. Jumping into the next key idea here, big idea, is organizational habits can be dangerous, but a crisis can change them. Research shows that many organizations are driven by the unofficial organizational habits that have emerged amid employees over time, rather than any deliberate decision-making processes. Consider the London Underground in 1987. Responsibilities in running the underground were divided into several clear-cut areas. And as a result, staff formed an organizational habit of not overstepping their departmental bounds. In fact, attempts to do so were met with scorn and anger. Under the surface, most organizations are like this. Battlegrounds in which individuals clamor for more power and rewards, habits such as minding one's own business form as ways to keep the peace. Unfortunately, some habits are dangerous. In 1987, at the King's Cross Underground Station, a ticket collector saw signs of a fire but didn't raise the alarm. It was his responsibility, but he didn't do it. The fire escalated, but no one present knew how to use the sprinkler system, or did they have the authority to use the fire extinguishers. They were someone else's responsibility. Within minutes, a huge fireball erupted into the ticket hall. Rescuers described passengers so badly burnt that their skin came off when touched. And in the end, 31 people died. But even such tragedies can have a silver lining. Crises offer a unique chance to remake organizational habits by providing a sense of emergency. This is why good leaders often actively prolong the sense of crisis or even exacerbate it. In investigating the fire, Desmond Fennell found that many potentially life-saving changes had been proposed years earlier, but no one had wanted to implement them and none have been implemented. And when Fennell encountered resistance to his suggestions, too, he turned the whole investigation into a media circus, a crisis that allowed him to implement the changes. Today, every station has a manager whose main responsibility is passenger safety. Companies take advantage of habits in their marketing. Retailers have long known more about the habits of shoppers than the shoppers themselves do. Retailers crawl through masses of data on customer behavior and then adapt their operations to maximize sales. For example, it's a surprising fact most people instinctively turn right when entering a store. Therefore, retailers put their most profitable products on the right side of the entrance. One of the masters of this method is Target, the American retailer that serves millions and millions of shoppers annually and collects the terabytes of data on them and figures out how to use it to their advantage. Now, their data analysis became so sophisticated that they could even tell when customers were pregnant and predict their due date because their shopping patterns changed and they started buying things like prenatal vitamins. By sending them baby-related coupons, Target could effectively lure them into their stores. The analysis worked so well that Target actually knew a teenage girl was pregnant before she had told her family. Target sent her baby-related coupons, prompting her father to pay the local Target manager an angry, angry visit. "She's still in high school. Are you trying to encourage her to get pregnant?" But when the truth came out, little did her dad know, it was the abashed father's turn to apologize. But Target soon realized that people resented being spied on. For its baby coupons to work, it indeed needed to bury them amid random, unrelated offers for things like lawn mowers and lawn supplies and gardening gloves. And the offers had to seem like the familiar, untargeted offers that came along with most everything else. When trying to sell anything new, companies will dress it up in something familiar. For example, radio DJs can guarantee a new song becomes popular by playing it sandwiched between two existing hit songs, a remix. This way, new habits or products are far more likely to be accepted. Companies take advantage of habits in their marketing. Now let's talk about how you can take advantage of habits within your own life. So movements are born from strong ties, peer pressure, and new habits. In 1955, a black woman named Rosa Parks refused to give up her bus seat for a white man in Montgomery, Georgia. She was arrested and she was charged, and the events that followed made her a civil rights icon. Increasingly, her case was neither unique nor was it the first. Interestingly, rather, her case wasn't unique or was it the first case of that kind. Many others had already actually been arrested for the same exact reason. So why did Parks' arrest spark a bus boycott that lasted over a year? Well, first of all, Rosa Parks was especially well-liked in the community and had an unusually broad array of friends. She belonged to lots of different clubs and lots of different societies and was closely connected to people from all walks of life, from professors to field hands and to just regular average Joes on the street. And these strong ties that she had bailed her out of jail and rapidly spread the word of her arrest throughout Montgomery, Georgia's social strata and the communities around it, organizing the bus boycott as a way of a protest to help her. But her friends alone couldn't have sustained a lengthy boycott like that. Enter peer pressure. So in addition to the strong ties and the people that were close to Rosa Parks, social spheres also compromise weak ties, meaning acquaintances rather than friends. It's most likely, or mostly via weak ties, that peer pressure is actually exerted. So when a person's friends and acquaintances support a movement, it's hard to opt out. Or to, in other words, to put it simply, people buckle when it comes to pressure. Whether that be wearing the same clothes that other people are wearing, or talking like their crowd talks, or doing something destructive, such as smoking because of the rest of the environment and being pressured into doing it. So back to Rosa Parks, eventually a commitment to the boycott began waning in the black community. It started kind of bubbling up and becoming this thing to be talked about. And as city officials began introducing new carpooling rules to make life without buses increasingly difficult, this is when the final component was added. A speech by Dr. Martin Luther King, advocating nonviolence and asking participants to embrace and forgive their oppressors. Based on this message, people began to form new habits, such as independently organizing church meetings and peaceful protests, and they made the movement a self-propelling force to be reckoned with. We bear the responsibility for changing our own habits. One night in 2008, Brian Thomas strangled his wife to death. Distraught, he promptly turned himself in and was prosecuted for murder. His defense? He was experiencing a sleep terror, like physically acting out a nightmare. Thomas thought he was strangling a burglar who was attacking his wife. In court, the defense argued that when Thomas thought someone was hurting his wife, it triggered an automatic response, and in this case, to protect her. In other words, he followed a habit. Around the same time, Angie Bachman was sued by the casino company Harrah's for $500,000 in outstanding gambling debts. This was after she had already gambled away her home and million-dollar inheritance. In court, Bachman argued that she, too, was merely following a habit. Gambling felt good. So when Harrah's, the casino company Harrah's, sent her tempting offers for free trips to the casino, she couldn't resist. Note that Harrah's, the casino company, knew she was a compulsive gambler who had already declared bankruptcy once before. In the end, Thomas was acquitted, and many, including the trial judge, expressed great sympathy for him. Bachman, on the other hand, lost the case and was the object of considerable public scorn. Both Thomas and Bachman could quite plausibly claim, "It wasn't me, it was my habits." So why was only one of them acquitted? Well, quite simply, once we become aware of a harmful habit, it becomes our responsibility, according to Duhigg, to address it and to change it. Thomas didn't know he would hurt anyone in his sleep. That's arguable, in parentheses, by the way. Bachman, however, knew she had a gambling habit, and she could have done something about it. She could have avoided Hera's offers by participating in an exclusion program that would have prohibited gambling companies from marketing to her in the first place. Again, we bear the responsibility for changing our own habits. So to close out this flash note, the key message in this book is basically this. Following habits is not only a key part of our lives, but also a key part of organizations and of companies. All habits comprise a cue, routine, reward, loop. Again, that's cue, routine, reward, loop. And the easiest way to change this is to substitute the routine for something else, while keeping the cue and the reward the same. So it's kind of like a sandwich, right? So you have your cue. That is, you have the urge to go and get your cookie at 12 p.m., just like you always do every single day as you're walking from the elevator out of the cafeteria back to your office, right? That's the cue. You get that urge to get that chocolate chip cookie. And the routine is for you to go over and to buy, wait in line, pick out the cookie, see the same person that rings you up every single day in the cafeteria, say hello to her, pay her, grab the cookie, and eat it gingerly on your way back to the elevator and up to your office. So that's the thing. So then as you eat it, that's the reward, by the way. So here's what you want to do. You want to replace that routine with something else. And that's what will allow you to actually replace that habit with something else. So when you get the urge to go and grab a cookie, you instead maybe pick another thing that you like to do that satisfies something that you had not typically done that week. Maybe that's writing in your journal. Maybe that's going to the vending machine and grabbing a bottled water or something healthier. Maybe that's going to the cafeteria and doing the same exact thing that you always do, and instead of getting a cookie, you grab a fruit smoothie or a veggie shake or a green juice or a vegetable or a piece of fruit or something healthy, a protein shake of some kind. So you go and you have that cue, the routine. You have the cue to go and get your chocolate chip cookie as usual. You walk on over to the snack area of the cafeteria, and instead of grabbing your cookie, you grab a chocolate protein shake. Much healthier, much better, and pretty much just as tasty as a chocolate chip cookie might be. And I know that's subjective, by the way. And then you pay for it, and you say hello to the same person who always rings you up, typically for the chocolate chip cookie, but instead today for the chocolate protein shake. And you pay for it, you crack it open, and instead of the cookie, which is bad for you and you want to replace that habit, you just sip on your protein shake on your way back to the elevator and up to your office, and boom. Eventually, over and over again, this habit, the bad habit, is then replaced with a better one. So achieving lasting change in life in any arena is difficult, but you can do it, and it can be done by focusing on important keystone habits such as willpower and being strategic about it. So some more closing takeaways here are, what are habits and why are they so hard to change? Well, habits, again, are simple and enduring cue, routine, reward loops that save effort. Habits stick because they create a craving. How can they be changed? Again, to change a habit, substitute the routine for another and believe in the change. Change can be achieved by focusing on keystone habits and achieving small wins. How do habits manifest themselves on a larger scale in society? Well, organizational habits can be dangerous, but a crisis can change them sometimes. And companies take advantage of habits in their marketing. Remember that as well. Movements are born from strong ties, peer pressure, and new habits. And then finally, bear in mind that if you want to change a habit, it is your responsibility, not anyone else's, to do so. If you enjoyed today's episode of the Flash Notes podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you took just a minute or so to review our podcast in iTunes. And if you're interested in learning more about Flash Notes book summaries, come on over to getflashnotes.com. Again, that's getflashnotes.com. And you can sign up for $1 and get access to business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. Thanks again for listening. My name is Dean Bukhari, and I will see you on the next episode right here on the Flash Notes podcast.